The gun was large and chrome-plated, the morning sun glinting off the polished surface. 4 times, the man pulled the trigger.
From Macmillan Podcasts, this is Case Closed. My name is Charlie Spicer. I'm an executive editor from St. Martin's Press, and I've edited hundreds of true crime books in my 33 years here. I know there's so much true crime out there already, and so much of it doesn't really have an ending. You're left feeling unresolved. For this show, we're going to talk about cases that do get resolved, where they catch the killer, where the evidence stacks up to a conviction. Our first season covers the murder of Rusty Snyderman. It was a gray November morning. Rusty drove up to his son's preschool, exited his car, and was shot 4 times in broad daylight. Who killed Rusty and why? We'll answer that question and find out what pushes an average person over the edge. Who really pulls the trigger? Tune in each week to Case Closed on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Can't wait to hear what really happened to Rusty Snyderman? Hear the full season right now on Stitcher Premium. Go to stitcherpremium.com/caseclosed and use code CLOSED to start your free trial. I'm Charlie Spicer. Thanks so much for listening.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Morris Lapidus, the architect who built the fabled Fontainebleau Hotel on Miami Beach, said, "If you create a stage and it is grand, everyone who enters will play their part." And as we heard in the last episode, they did. Ben Novak Sr. and his wife Bernice were king and queen of the Fontainebleau, and Ben Novak Jr. was the prince. The lonely prince, growing up without love and affection, without friends, without boundaries. The prince who preferred the company of strippers and prostitutes. And when his father lost his kingdom by the sea, Ben Novak Jr. built his own empire, fortifying it with money, the only thing he could ever count on. Growing up isolated and incapable of true intimacy and love, he chose for his wife a stripper, a woman who loved money as much as he did. Narcy Novak was also bad at relationships. Her only true love in life was money. And after almost 20 years of marriage, she saw the Novak fortune slipping out of her hands. So she brutally murdered her husband and mother-in-law so that she alone would hold the keys to the Novak kingdom. Welcome to episode 58, the conclusion to Miami Beach royalty, the Novak murders. Last week, we left off with Ben and Narcy reuniting, and then Ben signing a new will in January of 2006, leaving everything to Narcy. Unless he died before his mother, Bernice would get $200,000 and half interest in the Del Mar Place properties, and she was also named executor of his estate. There was another provision. If Narcy died before him, Ben bequeathed $250,000 to each of her grandsons, Patrick and Marcello, and $100,000 to May Abad, his stepdaughter. These are important codicils to his will because the first put the elderly Bernice Novak in Narcy's crosshairs, and the second, regarding her daughter and grandsons, will become very important after Ben's murder. I told you how Ben abruptly decided to drop criminal proceedings against his wife after the home invasion, and he also dropped the divorce. It was astonishing. Not just to the Fort Lauderdale police, who had invested a lot of man-hours on the attack, but to friends, family, and even the private investigator Ben had hired. Everyone knew that Ben Novak Jr. was being blackmailed by his wife, Narcy. Bernice Novak was very disturbed, not only by the attack on her son, but also the allegations made by Narcy about his sex life. Her neighbor said she was so upset she went to see a therapist for a while. She told her neighbor, "There you go. I knew what was going to happen. She only married my son for what he has and because she wants to control him." She understood intrinsically why her son stayed with Narcy. All she could do was stay close to him, be there for him, and she was. Though they hadn't had a close relationship when Ben was a child, he was extremely dependent on his mother in his adult years. John Glatt reported in his book, The Prince of Paradise, that Ben called her late at night to talk. He also called her over to get in the middle of fights between him and Narcy, to make peace. She told one friend despondently, "I never thought my life would be like this." She became depressed, and her chronic asthma worsened. She slept with an oxygen machine beside her bed. She called Ben during these attacks, but often had to drive herself to the emergency room. Despite his mother's frail health, Ben always called her when he needed something, even if it was just to rant on for hours on the phone. But he wasn't always available when she needed him. During this same time, Narcy Novak was reconnecting with her brothers, Cristobal and Carlos Feliz. Cristobal and his family came to visit every February. Cristobal's wife, Laura, reported that Ben Novak was odd and, quote, "very picky. Guests only stay in the guest house." According to Laura, the Novak marriage was very strained. Other friends of the couple reported to author John Glatt that they seemed very in love, ready to move on with their lives together. It is certainly possible they showed a different face to friends than family. Many people do. It's funny, though. Bernice would talk about how horrible Narcy was and how she didn't trust her. And then Laura, on the other hand, said that Ben was demanding and spoke abusively to his wife. She also claimed that they put Cristobal in the middle, the same way they did with Bernice. And who should we believe? Maybe both. Bernice had good reason to feel the way she did about her daughter-in-law, and Ben Novak could definitely be salty with Narcy's family. I think the point is, intimate family members did not see a happy couple working things out. They saw a couple constantly at war. In the early spring of 2008, Ben answered an ad for a $300-an-hour prostitute on a site called CityVibe.com. Her name was Rebecca Bliss, and she was a former porn star who went by the name Mona Love. In 2007, she retired from porn and became a tattoo artist, but her boyfriend at the time shot her in the leg and hand, ending that career. Down on her luck, unable or unwilling to go back to porn, she chose prostitution. She said that her first visit with Ben was strictly business, and he paid $600. She said they did talk quite a bit, though, and he kept calling her. She told author John Glatt and the TV show 48 Hours that they spoke every day on the phone. By June of 2008, Ben was in love with Rebecca and moved her into a luxury apartment in Fort Lauderdale, paying all of her living expenses so she no longer had to do sex work. He even named himself as husband on the lease he signed for her. That same summer, Ben invited Maya Bod and her sons to move into his guest house. She would continue working in his office, slowly taking on more responsibility and helping with conventions. His plan was so that Narcy could spend less time in the office. But he also told a hotel events coordinator at his last convention that he was grooming May to take over the whole business. There has been a lot of back and forth over how Ben really felt about May Abad, and I think ultimately, we may never really know. But if he had enough faith in her to talk about her taking over his business and moved her onto his property, I think he did care for his stepdaughter. In July of 2008, Bernice Novak made a new will. An earlier will had left everything to Ben Jr., except for $50,000 to her sister Maxine and $15,000 each to her nieces, Meredith and Lisa. Of course, if Ben failed to survive her, that meant everything would go to Narcy. She told a close friend that she would do anything to make sure that Narcy didn't get her hands on her fortune or property. So in her new will, she left her entire estate to the Jewish Federation. There is no mention of her sister or nieces. Ben Novak Jr. was a millionaire in his own right, but when he found out his mother planned to change her will, he went ballistic. He complained that he and Narcy had two mortgages to pay off. I think this speaks to his character. He didn't need his mother's money. He just felt entitled to it. and after he blew up at her, she left the will on her desk and never took it to her lawyer. So when she died, her estate passed to Ben Jr. Meanwhile, by the end of the summer, Narcy became suspicious that Ben was cheating on her. She found receipts where he had bought furniture and finally figured out he was furnishing an apartment Narcy didn't know about. May Abad later claimed that she herself found the receipts and confronted her stepfather, who told her about Rebecca Bliss and that he planned to divorce her mother. She claims he promised he would still take care of her and her sons. She told many reporters that her mother was very jealous, but I think that's been made pretty clear several times. Another friend of Ben's said the affair was incidental. That things had gotten so bad at home, Ben was intending to file for divorce anyway. He was just trying to get his affairs in order. Naturally, Rebecca Bliss said that he told her he was divorcing Narcy to marry her. No disrespect to Miss Bliss, but that's generally what most cheating husbands say. Maybe he was head over heels for her. Hell, Narcy was a stripper when he met her. He did not have the snobbery or natural aversion to sex work that many people have. But we cannot know for sure. I think it's fair to say he knew his marriage was over, regardless of Rebecca Bliss, though. When Narcy found out about the affair, she started trying to get Ben and Rebecca arrested. She called the FBI to report an immigration fraud scheme. She said he would set up sham marriages and claimed Rebecca Bliss was being put up in an apartment because she was set to marry a foreign convention guest. She also accused her husband of using cocaine and hinted at secret trips on a private airplane to and from Mexico. In the early fall, Narcy and Ben went to Puerto Vallarta. Narcy called Mexican customs officials and claimed that Ben was carrying $10,000 illegally and was also carrying a gun without a permit. So he was stopped before boarding a plane home. No money was found, and they soon learned Ben was a retired police officer from his reserve days with the Miami Beach Police, and he did indeed have a permit to carry a concealed weapon. When the FBI questioned her about the Mexico trip and her accusations, she denied it. Needless to say, even with her earlier claims about her husband, the FBI dismissed Narcy's stories, finding that she was not credible. She had also taken to calling Rebecca Bliss, and supposedly at one point offered Bliss $10,000 to get out of Ben's life, which Bliss refused. She called Bliss numerous times, shouting in rage. Rebecca Bliss said Narcy screamed that they were not getting a divorce, and if she couldn't have him, no one could. Obviously, this isn't the first report of Narcy saying this exact thing. It's what she said to her husband after the home invasion, when she left him tied to the chair. And she began stalking Rebecca Bliss in earnest. She found out where her mother lived, and Bliss had a daughter she didn't have custody of, and Narcy even found her. Then in January of 2009, Narcy called the apartment complex where Rebecca lived and told them that her husband, Ben Novak Jr., had died and would no longer be paying the rent. The rental agent was confused by the call and told her to send a copy of his death certificate. Narcy never did. But by now, failing to get Rebecca Bliss out of Ben's life and also failing to get him in trouble with the FBI or federales, Narcy's plan took a sinister turn. She had decided that Ben must die. And she also knew that Bernice being the executor of Ben's estate would be a problem. She also merely wanted the old woman's portion of Ben's fortune. She wanted every last penny for herself. And so she started planning both murders with the help of her brother Cristobal. I'm going to pause here for a commercial break. Narcy Novak bought a burner phone and kept in close contact with her brothers Cristobal and Carlos. Cristobal was to set everything up for her. They were going to hire hitmen. Cristobal spent his time networking and making contacts, looking for just the right men. On Wednesday, February 11th, 2009, two hitmen hired by Cristobal made their first attempt on Bernice's life. They were seen and chased off by a vigilant neighbor. One of them threw an iron lawn ornament through Bernice's window as he ran off. Bernice was terrified by this and called Ben, who told her everything was fine and to just make sure the alarm system was on. But she still called the Fort Lauderdale police and made a report. She was very shaken up. Cristobal Valiz was pissed that the first plan had failed, and the men he hired now wanted nothing more to do with him. But a few weeks later, he met a Nicaraguan immigrant named Alejandro Garcia. Garcia was a crack addict with a long rap sheet who was in America past his six-month work visa. He was hungry for the money, and though his record was for petty crimes, he didn't seem fazed by the plan to attack an 86-year-old woman. Garcia would later say in court that, quote, "The plan was for me to give her a good beating and hit her in the teeth." Supposedly, Cristobal told him that Bernice made Ben beat Narcy every day as part of the Jewish religion. He also said that Ben abused Narcy sexually, that he forced anal sex and blowjobs on his wife. This might be a hitman trying to justify his actions as not just motivated by money, but I wouldn't put anything past Cristobal or Narcy. Either way, they all caught a lucky break when on March 28th, Bernice Novak took a nasty spill outside the Bank of America. She had been inside putting her 5-carat diamond ring in a safety deposit box. She was still shaken up by the recent vandalism of her home. She tripped over a break in the sidewalk and landed face down on the pavement. The bank staff rushed out to help and offered to call an ambulance, but she refused. She drove herself home and then called Ben to tell him what had happened. Ben was out of town, but the minute he got in, he went to see his mother and insisted she get checked out at the hospital. She was covered in cuts, scrapes, and bruises, but other than that, not seriously injured. But Ben was furious and wanted to sue the Bank of America for negligence for the broken sidewalk. Bernice had her neighbor take photos of her injuries. Her neighbor recalled how awful Bernice looked. Being 86 years old, her skin was very thin and she was skinned up all over. The reason I say this was a lucky break is now Bernice Novak had a recorded and recent history of falls. This would very much work to Narcy and Cristobal's advantage. On Saturday, April 4th, Bernice still wasn't feeling great and had stayed home all day. It was the 34th anniversary of Ben Sr.'s death and her son called to check on her. She told him that she missed his father terribly. After this, and another phone call with one of her friends, it was getting dark, so Bernice changed into her nightgown and poured herself a glass of Chardonnay. Ben would later question this detail, insisting his mother didn't drink wine. But her sister Maxine said she often had a glass at night to relax, though she insisted Bernice was not a heavy drinker. A little before 9:30 p.m., Alejandro Garcia hid a large monkey wrench in his pants and grabbed a bottle of rum and went to hide in Bernice's bushes. He was waiting for her to come outside and move her car into the garage. A creature of habit, Bernice always moved her car into the garage at night. Narcy knew this, and the plan was always for her attacker to wait for her to come outside. Which was very smart. No witnesses and no forced entry. Garcia's accomplice, a man named Melvin Medrano, was waiting nearby in a getaway car. Medrano was one of the men in the first plot to kill Bernice that had failed. Now they stayed in touch by cell phone. Suddenly, Bernice came outside just as expected. She opened her car remotely, then got inside and drove it the few feet into her garage. Garcia slipped into the garage behind her car. When she shut off the engine and opened the door to get out, Alejandro Garcia viciously swung the wrench. He would later testify that she saw him first and screamed. He hit her several times, and as she fell into the car, he reached in and grabbed the steering wheel with his left hand as he beat her in the head with his right. He later said he couldn't remember how many times he hit her. Then he calmly wiped his fingerprints off the wrench and the steering wheel of the car and fled. He said she was slumped across the driver's seat the last time he saw her. He ran and got into the waiting car with Medrano, and the two drove to Miami. But Bernice wasn't dead. Bleeding and in shock, she pulled herself out of her car and made her way to the laundry room door leading into her house. She left a trail of blood the entire way. The blood trail led through her kitchen and living room and then into a half bathroom. Frail, 86-year-old Bernice Novak was aware of what was happening as she lost control of her bowels. There was evidence that she tried to clean herself up in the bathroom. Her underwear was found near the commode, and blood and feces were mixed together all over the floor. Author John Glatt posited in his book, The Prince of Paradise, that Bernice then realized that she had left her door open and her attacker could come back, so she staggered back to the laundry room and locked the door. She then tried to reach the panic button on her alarm system, but fell to the floor dying before she could. Glatt's recreation of the crime scene and Bernice's movements are extremely intuitive. He worked from crime scene photographs and the autopsy report. The first blow Bernice received was to her face, fracturing her skull and knocking her glasses to the garage floor. The second blow broke her jaw, knocking out some of her teeth. There were at least three more blows to her head with the wrench. It was a vicious attack. Alejandro Garcia would later claim he was only supposed to injure Bernice and put her in the hospital. He also later claimed he didn't even know she had died, that Cristobal told him she was in the hospital. Again, I call bullshit. You cannot bludgeon anyone, much less an elderly woman, that many times over the head with a heavy wrench and not have intent to kill. The next morning, at 5:30 a.m., Bernice's neighbor noticed her garage door open, but didn't want to call and wake her up. When she did call a couple of hours later, she didn't get an answer, so she went and knocked on the door. She had seen Bernice's car in the garage with the lights still on and was getting uneasy. When Bernice didn't answer the door, she went home and called Ben Novak Jr. Ben called the Fort Lauderdale police immediately to check on his mother as he and Narcy jumped in the car heading to Bernice's house. They got there before the police. Ben found his mother in a pool of blood, face down. He checked her pulse and found that she was already dead. He called the police back this time to report her death. From the start, the Fort Lauderdale police did not suspect foul play. They thought she had fallen. There were no signs of forced entry, and nothing had been stolen or ransacked. Her purse and jewelry were all out in plain sight. The detective on scene spoke with one of Ben's friends who told him of Bernice's recent fall, and he noted this as well as the glass of wine in his notes. Bernice Novak's body was transported to the Broward County Medical Examiner for autopsy. The ME found multiple fractures, which caused internal bleeding in her brain, fractures in her jaw, and one to her ring finger. Despite the numerous, grievous blunt force injuries, the ME ruled her death an accident, caused by an unwitnessed fall at her home. The assistant ME would later insist he did not believe it was an accident, saying, "I've never seen injuries like this from someone falling." He said he was overruled by the medical examiner, Dr. Iori Boyko, who had visited the scene at Bernice's house to help make his ruling. And he wasn't alone in his findings. The Fort Lauderdale police agreed, and even some old cop buddies of Ben who walked the scene at his insistence also felt there was nothing suggesting foul play. With the absence of forced entry, every door in the house was locked, and without any robbery, it did look like a tragic accident. The theory would be that she fell once in the garage and then kept falling as she made her way through the house. So a series of falls, along with a few glasses of wine, caused the incredible injuries to Bernice Novak's skull and face. That is difficult to accept, and Ben Novak Jr. didn't. He and her sister Maxine would insist that Bernice Novak was not a drinker, and the injuries were much more serious than she would have received in a fall. But their worries fell on deaf ears. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsor. Wouldn't it be nice to use just one program to help you achieve your health and weight loss goals? Just one place for your workouts, calorie trackers, and meal planning? Well, let me tell you about Noom and how they can help you live a healthier lifestyle. I've been on a self-care journey this year to exercise more and make healthier food choices. With the Noom app on my phone, I've got support in the palm of my hand whenever I need it. Because Noom is a habit-changing solution that helps you form a new healthy relationship to food with personalized courses. Noom has one of the biggest and most accurate databases for you to track meals, count calories, and really visualize portion sizes. And if you get off track, no worries. There's no shaming, just tips to help you get back on track tomorrow. So take that first step and sign up for your trial today at Noom, Noom.com/southernfried. What are you waiting for? Visit Noom.com/southernfried to start your trial today. Again, that's Noom.com/southernfried. It's the last weight loss program you'll need. Thank you. Even while Bernice's body still lay in the house, Ben Novak Jr. noticed that his mother's diamond ring was missing. This only fueled his belief that it was indeed a robbery. He and Narcy would find the ring a few days later when they checked her safe deposit boxes. With Narcy's help, he moved his mother's jewelry and heirlooms to one of his safe deposit boxes. The very night Bernice was found, Narcy made arrangements for her body to be cremated as soon as possible. Within 24 hours, before any of Bernice's family or relatives could be formally notified. A memorial service was planned for the following Friday. Her sister Maxine, who lived out of state, said she did not have time to make arrangements to get to her funeral. She was very suspicious by how rushed it all was. Bernice Novak's obituary appeared in the Miami Herald on Thursday, April 9th. Her age was incorrectly listed. At her memorial service, Ben rose to give the eulogy and admitted he had not prepared a speech. George Rodriguez, Bernice's longtime boyfriend, was shocked by the eulogy, where Ben revealed his mother's time in foster care, as well as her real age. These were her two biggest secrets, and she would have been mortified. He also compared his mother's death to the actress Natasha Richardson, who had recently died from a head injury she got while skiing. It was bizarre and had nothing to do with his mother. He then spoke about her strained relationship with Narcy, saying that they had gotten along better in recent years. I'm sure Ben's awkward and inappropriate eulogy was due to his being in shock, but it was hurtful to friends and family in attendance, as Bernice Stemple Novak had led a truly remarkable life and deserved so much better. Making matters worse, the Novaks hosted a reception at the Bonaventure Country Club in Fort Lauderdale after the funeral. It was a party, featuring a country and western band. Narcy even got up to sing. While this might sound appropriate for some funerals, it was not for Bernice Novak. Bernice didn't even like country music, and she was also the epitome of dignity and refinement. She would have been appalled at this tacky reception. Narcy had also upset mourners at the memorial because she had cut her hair and dyed it red in Bernice's style for the event. Walking around in a tight but expensive black dress, never removing her sunglasses, she greeted mourners as if she was at a convention. Also, in the days and weeks after her death, Bernice's friends and relatives were angry at how her death was reported in the press. They were angry at Bernice being portrayed as a drinker who simply had too much wine and fell. And they were angrier still that the case was closed so abruptly. Ben filed a wrongful death suit against the Bank of America for Bernice's earlier fall, insisting internal injuries led to the second fall that caused her death. He was angry and lashing out, but he also had a history of being very litigious. Narcy, not Ben, cleaned out Bernice's house, going through her possessions, keeping what she wanted, and throwing out Bernice's beloved book collection. Ben inherited his mother's estate per her original will, as she had never taken the new will to her lawyer. Her sister Maxine received $50,000, and her nieces got small amounts as well. Everything else went to Ben Novak Jr., an estimated $2 million estate. And now Narcy and her brother Cristobal moved on to the next part of their plan, to have Ben killed. They planned it for months, deciding that it would be better if it didn't happen in Florida. Ben and Narcy had a convention planned for July at the Hilton in Rybrook, New York. They planned to use Garcia and Medrano again for Ben's hit. But Medrano was arrested and deported back to Nicaragua on an unrelated charge, so Cristobal had Alejandro Garcia looking for a new partner. Cristobal offered Garcia $15,000 for the hit on Ben. Joel Gonzalez then stepped into the picture. Garcia offered him $3,000 and Gonzalez agreed immediately. Both men were supposedly told they were just supposed to injure Ben Novak. To be more precise, cut off his balls. Either way, Narcy wanted him unable to ever work again. Of course this was a lie. Whether it is the lie of Garcia and Gonzalez minimizing their participation, or if they were truly lied to by Narcy and Cristobal, is anyone's guess. On May 5th, 2009, Ben Novak finally got the Batmobile he had commissioned. It was $128,000 and he was delighted. But as fate would have it, he only got to drive it once, and that was to get gas before he parked it in a secure garage. Towards the end of June, Ben and Narcy had dinner with Kelsey Grammer and his wife. As I told you in the last episode, they were pals from their private school days. Grammer later reported to police that he felt something was wrong and that Narcy acted strangely. Then, on June 26th, Ben Novak Jr. hired a divorce attorney. But the attorney soon called Ben and told him he was dropping the case because he had received threats. He did not elaborate, but he wanted nothing to do with the Novak divorce. But it's clear, not just from what family, close friends, and Ben's mistress said, that Ben Novak was finally ready to pull the plug on his marriage, no matter what it cost him. At a convention over the 4th of July in Fort Lauderdale, Narcy made a point of telling two different business associates that Ben had a lot of enemies. One was a vendor trying to settle his bill, and the other a longtime friend who knew of Ben's callous manner in business. Neither man found the statements odd at the time, but they did after Ben's murder. Ben and Narcy arrived in New York on Thursday, July 9th. This would be just less than 2 weeks since Ben had first tried to hire a divorce attorney. It would appear that he planned to blindside Narcy with the divorce, and in the meantime, keep business going as usual. Considering how she reacted in the past, it seems smart on his part. But he had no idea what she was planning and how far she would go. On Friday, the hitmen, Alejandro Garcia and Joel Gonzalez, scouted the Hilton in Rybrook, New York. They are caught on security camera footage a little before 3 p.m., actually walking right past Ben Novak Jr. in the front lobby. The first night of the convention went off as planned, and Ben Novak talked to the hotel's event director for a while that night, pointing out his stepdaughter, Maya Abad, and expressing how proud he was of her. He told the woman he looked forward to retiring and letting May handle the day-to-day work. Again, I have discussed different perspectives on the relationship between Ben and his stepdaughter, but this event director was not a friend or family member. She had no reason to lie. But it does seem strange if he was about to divorce May's mother. But then again, May had a terrible relationship with Narcy. Ben knew that. And it's quite possible that May Abad was the only person he felt he had left in his life whom he could trust. Maybe he did have true affection for his stepdaughter. Saturday, July 11th also went well at the convention, with staffers locking a total of $110,000 in registration fees in their hotel room safes afterwards. Around midnight, Ben and Narcy retired to their room, using the hotel key at 12:07 a.m. Narcy had also offered to help with the departing breakfast the next morning, something she had never done before. She went to bed, but Ben stayed up late working on his laptop, as he often did, studying spreadsheets, answering email, and searching eBay for more Batman collectibles. When the hitmen showed up at the Hilton Hotel at 5:10 a.m., the light was still on in Ben and Narcy's room. Ben was still up working. They called Cristobal, who told them to wait for his call. Ben finally turned off the light and went to bed at 6:30 a.m. Narcy called Cristobal at 6:39. At 6:54 a.m., the hotel events director called Ben's phone because attendees were already lining up for breakfast, but none of Ben's staff was there to register them. Remember, Narcy had told her she would be there to help. But she wasn't there. She may not have anticipated her husband staying up so late. Ben did answer the phone and then called May to take care of it and went back to sleep. It was 7 a.m. when the hitmen arrived in the Novak suite. Narcy was waiting in the doorway to let them in. She put a finger to her lips to make sure they were quiet and then pointed to the bedroom where Ben was sleeping. She then led the men to the kitchen, where they removed their dress shirts and shoes. They had shopped for appropriate clothing beforehand so they wouldn't stick out at the hotel. They put on gloves and then pulled dumbbells out of a gym bag, Garcia's weapon of choice this time. They got on either side of the bed, and Garcia counted to three, and then the men pounced. Ben Novak Jr., clad in just boxers and his black socks, awoke and began screaming and fighting back. Alejandro testified later that they just hit him everywhere, his head, chest, ribs, and abdomen. As Ben struggled, he knocked the sunglasses off of Garcia's face, breaking off a piece of the glasses. Ironically, considering what was coming, Alejandro Garcia was blind in one eye and couldn't stand the light. Gonzalez said he became scared and walked into the kitchen, but Narcy told him to go back. She walked in with him and handed him a pillow to muffle her husband's screams. Gonzalez walked off again as Garcia kept pummeling Ben. He testified that when he walked back in again, with Narcy screaming at him, Ben was now on the floor beside the bed and Garcia was hitting him with the dumbbell. Gonzalez said Ben was no longer moving but was moaning in pain. Then the men used duct tape to tie Ben's legs together and his hands behind his back. Gonzalez said at this point, Ben wasn't fighting, but was breathing hard and had a lot of blood coming out of his mouth. Gonzalez again walked back to the kitchen, where Narcy was pacing. Alejandro Garcia now pulled out a utility knife and grabbed Ben by his hair. He plunged the blade into Ben's left eye and turned it. He did the same thing to his right eye as Ben moaned in agony. He then went to see Narcy, who asked him if he had cut Ben's eyes. He assured her that he did and that Ben would never see again, but offered to cut his eyes more if she wanted. She said no. Then she ordered Garcia to, quote, finish him off, as Ben was still making weak noises, clinging to life despite the brutal attack. Garcia went back to the bedroom and wrapped duct tape around Ben Novak's head and mouth tightly. Ben Novak Jr. then choked to death on his own vomit. Narcy handed the killers towels to clean up at the sink. As they redressed, she went and took a bracelet off of Ben's wrist. It was gold and spelled Ben out in diamonds. He loved the bracelet. She handed it to Garcia, who put it in his bag. Originally, the plan was to tie Narcy up and leave her in the room so it would look like a robbery. But Narcy had changed her mind. Instead, they all left the suite together, with the killers taking a nearby stairwell as Narcy walked down the hall. The hitmen were caught on surveillance footage in the lobby at 7:11 a.m. It had taken less than 10 minutes to torture and murder Ben Novak. Narcy had purposely walked down the hallway, seen on a security camera at 7:09 a.m., pulling a small suitcase. For 18 minutes, she stood in one place, appearing to make phone calls on her cell. She called May Abad at 7:19, and then Ben's phone at 7:31. She was setting up an alibi. Investigators believed that she knew exactly where the security cameras were. When she finally came down to the convention for breakfast, May noticed she wasn't wearing any makeup. Her mother always wore makeup. She also said she was even more snappish than usual and acting strangely. Narcy then went back upstairs to her suite and used the key card to get in at 7:45 a.m. She immediately came out of the room screaming. She leaned against the wall in the hallway, screaming, "Help me! Help my husband!" A nearby guest went into the suite and saw Ben's body and, as one does, started snapping photographs of the gruesome scene with his cell phone. When he came back out, a crowd was gathering around the hysterical Narcy. He said she then ran back into the room and climbed on top of her dead husband, straddling him, though he was lying face down, hogtied. He said she began beating him in the shoulders with her fists. By 7:50, the Hilton Hotel security was called, and the guard was told a man was having a heart attack. He ran to the fourth floor suite and found Narcy screaming on top of her husband's body. He said she screamed, "Why me? Why is this happening?" His first instinct was to preserve evidence, so he lifted Narcy up and put her on a chair. He had to continue to sit and hold her back as other security arrived and secured the scene. At 7:56, EMS arrived expecting a heart attack. They checked for a pulse and found none. They even hooked him up to a heart monitor, and it was flatlined. He was already blue. The EMS attendant pronounced Ben Novak Jr. dead at 7:59 a.m. May Abad soon entered the suite, and one of the EMS attendants heard her ask Narcy where the money was. Narcy then told another employee to go collect the bags with the $110,000 they had collected the night before and put it in the hotel's main safe. It doesn't look good that May was asking about the money, but I also think she could have been subtly accusing her mother of taking it. By all accounts, she was dedicated to Ben's company and was a responsible employee. The chief of security said he overheard May in the hallway telling her mother to pull herself together. He said May told her mother to shut up and stop it or she was going to throw up, seemingly upset at Narcy's hysterics. At 8:30 a.m., Cristobal met the hitmen at a Dunkin' Donuts and paid them in $100 bills. He gave Garcia $7,000 and Gonzalez $3,000. Presumably, Garcia would receive his final payment back in Florida. I'm going to pause here for a final commercial break. Rybrook, New York is about 20 miles north of New York City. It's an affluent small town, but not equipped to handle a murder investigation of this magnitude. Other police departments from Westchester County were called in to help with the investigation. The first detectives on scene immediately noted that there were no signs of a break-in or even really a struggle, other than Ben Novak's bloodied corpse. He had obviously been attacked as he slept, with a lot of blood on the bed sheets and floor beside it. In the sheets, they found Ben's gold Rolex that had fallen off in the attack, covered in blood. They also found a piece from a pair of knockoff Valentino sunglasses. Alejandro Garcia had forgotten to go back for that bit of evidence. Ben's laptop sat on the desk with a bank bag with $15,000 cash inside, out in the open, not in the room safe. They did find droplets of blood in the sink where the hitmen had cleaned up, but other than that, the room had not been ransacked and nothing appeared to be stolen. Narcy readily answered any questions the detectives had for her, including when they asked if Ben had any enemies, and she said many, even some within the Miami Beach Police Department. By 5:30, Ben's body was taken to the medical examiner's office. Police stayed with Narcy. At 7:30, a senior investigator came to question Narcy. He had just spent several hours talking to May Abad and now had new questions. Narcy again went over the list of Ben's enemies, including a comic book dealer he had recently argued with. The dealer would later say it was a negotiation, not an argument. The detective showed Narcy the piece of sunglasses they found, and she immediately claimed it was hers. She said she broke her pair on the flight to New York, and Ben was probably trying to fix them. He liked to fix things, she claimed. But when asked where the rest of the sunglasses were, if Ben was trying to fix them, Narcy looked puzzled. She paused, and then said she had lost them on the plane. When the detective pointed out that this didn't make sense if Ben was trying to fix the glasses, Narcy just said, I don't know. Around midnight, May Abad went to the hotel safe to get money to pay the Convention Concepts unlimited staff for that weekend. She also took enough money to pay for an event the following week. I think this explains May's question about the money that was overheard by EMS. She knew her stepfather always paid his bills. She felt responsible for the staff and intended to keep business going as usual. It is probably what Ben would have wanted. Ben Novak Jr.'s autopsy took place around 10 a.m. on Monday morning. Along with the numerous blunt force injuries to his head, the gruesome injuries to both eyes, when they opened him up, they found more than 20 fractures to his ribs. The pathologist said they were so smashed, they resembled chicken bones. While Ben Novak did asphyxiate on his own vomit, the medical examiner noted that any of the hemorrhages on his brain or lungs could have killed him. Meanwhile, hotel management was concerned about the remaining $105,000 in their safe. It was too much money to be responsible for. Narcy immediately said she would take it with her to Fort Lauderdale, but a detective said that was not safe and she should deposit it in a local bank. So he drove her to a bank and then watched as a teller handed Narcy a stack of money from the deposit she was making. It was $5,000 that Narcy pocketed right there in front of the detective. By 11:30 a.m. that day, Ben's death was made public. Investigators would not say much except that they felt it was not a random attack, but someone with a connection to Ben Novak Jr. By 6 p.m. that same evening, investigators were prepared to formally interview Narcy Novak on camera. They were already fairly certain she was involved with the murder. Narcy had made a huge mistake by letting the killers into the room. Investigators now knew from hotel security that the card was only used to enter the suite at 12:07 a.m. after the convention and at 7:45 a.m. when Narcy came back upstairs and found Ben's body. There was no other way in or out of the fourth floor suite. She had to have let them in. And they didn't buy her bullshit story about the sunglasses either. She should have feigned ignorance completely instead of trying to make up a story. Either way, they had also now received a tip from someone in Fort Lauderdale about the 2002 home invasion that Narcy orchestrated. And Narcy had already quite willingly told investigators about her husband's preference for kinky sex, specifically that he liked to be tied up in the manner that he was found. It didn't feel like a coincidence to investigators. So for the next 8 hours, they grilled Narcy Novak. She remained composed, but several hours into the interview, the gloves came off. She was confronted about the home invasion. She denied it happened, insisting Ben made it all up, that he was into rough sex, and pointed out that they got back together after the incident. She also denied robbing the house, indignantly saying that she only moved her own things out, as was her right. She also claimed her husband was a pedophile, along with his fetish for amputees. Changing tactics, one detective asked Narcy if anyone pressured her into letting them into the suite that morning. Narcy acted confused, even when the detective point-blank said, "You opened that door for them." She adamantly denied the accusation and then asked if she was a suspect. She offered to take 100 lie detector tests to prove she was innocent. She probably thought she could beat the machine. So the detectives called her bluff and set her up for a polygraph examination with the New York State Police, which she failed several times. When Narcy was being shown the negative results, May Abad burst into the room and tried to attack her. May now was sure her mother had killed her stepfather. But as we know, polygraph tests are not admissible, and Narcy Novak had held up well under questioning. They had nothing more than circumstantial evidence, and even that was weak. So Tuesday afternoon, Narcy flew back to Fort Lauderdale. The Rybrook police called the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to put her under surveillance. Narcy immediately hired armed guards for her home and went to her local bank asking to withdraw the $100,000 in cash that she had deposited in New York. When the bank teller told her they didn't keep that much cash on hand, she settled for half in cash and the rest in two cashier's checks. She also decided to kick May Abad out of the guest house where she had been living. She came after her daughter with a crowbar. It's caught on her own camera's security footage. Narcy strikes May, who threw her arm up to protect her head, getting a nasty bruise on her bicep. May filed a complaint with Fort Lauderdale police against Narcy for aggravated battery. They claimed to have investigated the complaint, but took no action, which is strange as the incident was caught on camera. Meanwhile, Narcy flew back to New York and gave one cashier's check to her brother Carlos, presumably for him to give to Cristobal, and the other cashier's check to an attorney named Howard Tanner for legal services. She was anticipating being charged in New York, but also, under federal law, she had just laundered that money. On July 16th, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement served a 7-page warrant on the Del Mar Place house. On the same day, reporter Julie Brown with the Miami Herald dug up Ben Novak Jr.'s original divorce petition from 2002. This was incredibly damaging for Narcy, as it outlined Ben's fears that she would kill him and included the quote, "If I can't have you, no one will. The men who helped me will come back and finish the job." That same day, the Miami Herald asked the Broward County Medical Examiner for Bernice Novak's autopsy report. Reporter Julie Brown was dogged in her attempt to show that Narcy was also responsible for Bernice's murder, that hadn't actually been investigated as a murder. The Fort Lauderdale police still insisted they would not reopen Bernice Novak's case. After the 2002 home invasion, the Fort Lauderdale Police Department had seemingly wanted to wash their hands of the Novak family. They had obstinately refused to investigate Bernice's death, despite pleas from Ben and many other friends and family. But on July 21st, an anonymous letter was sent to the Miami Springs Police Department. It was 5 pages, handwritten, in broken English. The writer accused Narcy Novak and her brother Cristobal Valiz of orchestrating the murders of Bernice and Ben Novak Jr. The letter writer knew enough details, like about Bernice's previous fall, that the letter was deemed genuine. Police felt it was written by an older, religious woman, as there were many lines like, "I write out of respect for God." She wrote that Narcy Novak would stop at nothing to get her hands on the Novak Millions. Police took the letter very seriously, but it would take 3 years to identify the author, who was indeed Narcy's older sister, Letitia Tirano, who was very religious and was horrified at what her siblings had done. Meanwhile, the news stories weren't limited to Miami or New York. The Associated Press had picked up the story, and it was now a salacious national scandal. During all of this, no one had claimed Ben Novak Jr.'s body from the New York morgue. His aunt, Maxine Phil, was shocked and told the press, quote, "Here is the Prince of Fountain Blue, and he's being treated no better than a homeless person." No one could claim Ben's body except Narcy, who was his legal next of kin. Actor Kelsey Grammer even spoke up, offering to pay for Ben's funeral, but Narcy refused. Narcy was more than willing to let Ben sit on ice as she worked moving money and removing valuable items, like Bernice's jewelry collection, from Ben's safe deposit boxes. Her name was not on the boxes, but she conned a bank employee into giving her access. The employee was not aware of Ben's murder, and Narcy promised he would be by that afternoon to add her name. She also moved all of his Batman collection out of the warehouses where it was stored into new warehouses. It was the second largest collection in the world and worth millions. She had again conned the warehouse men into believing Ben was alive and aware of the move. On July 29th, Narcy petitioned Broward County Circuit Court to be named as executor to Ben's estate. She also requested to have her husband cremated. The court refused the second request, as it was specified in Ben's will that he was to be buried in his family's mausoleum in Queens, New York. On August 7th, May Abad filed her own petition, objecting to her mother being named executor of Ben's estate. This would kick off years of legal battles over Ben Novak Jr.'s fortune. By August 14th, May persuaded a circuit court judge to freeze Ben Novak Jr.'s assets, as well as remove Narcy as executor of his estate, while his murder investigation was still underway. Broward County hired probate attorney Douglas Hoffman to act as curator of Ben's estate, and his first action was to arrange for Ben Novak's burial. But after numerous hearings with Hoffman trying to recover money and items that Narcy had already taken, she did finally agree to adhere to his will and let him be buried. Ben Novak Jr. was laid to rest on September 2, 2009. His aunt, Maxine Phil, spoke to the press and said she felt at peace, but, quote, "she let him lay there for 52 days. And then she said she heard that Kelsey Grammer had indeed paid for the funeral. During these weeks, police were starting to uncover holes in Narcy's story. They questioned Cristobal and, while at his house, noticed Western Union payments to two men. One was Alejandro Garcia. On August 31st, Cristobal, aware that he was about to be implicated, called a New York investigator and said he had overheard another man arranging to give money to Alejandro Garcia at a Miami gas station the morning after the meeting. By September 10th, May Abad took the gloves off and outright accused her mother of murdering her stepfather in probate court. Now Cristobal and Narcy wanted May Abad dead. They had already tried to plan to get her arrested weeks before when she first petitioned the court. The plan was to plant drugs in her car and tip off the police, but it never happened. Cristobal called up Alejandro Garcia and told him he had another job for him. Despite much pressure from Rybrook detectives, Fort Lauderdale police announced in mid-October that they had no intention of reopening Bernice Novak's case. But now, the FBI had stepped into the investigation. By mid-November, investigators were ready to arrest Alejandro Garcia for Ben Novak Jr.'s murder. He and Joel Gonzalez were identified on hotel security footage after Cristobal's tip. The police still believed that Narcy and her brother hired the hitmen, but they needed the killers to roll on them first. They arrested Alejandro Garcia and then Joel Gonzalez, but they took their time. They wanted the case against Narcy and Cristobal to be airtight. In March, the FBI seized assets from Ben Novak Jr.'s estate and barred Narcy from taking the title of the Batmobile and other antique cars, boats, and other expensive items. The Miami Herald pointed out that their sealed warrants meant that the FBI Violent Crimes Task Force was gathering evidence to prove that Narcy Novak had been involved in a criminal conspiracy for financial gain. Investigators now realized that with Alejandro Garcia cooperating with the government, that May Abad's life was in danger. But witness protection paperwork takes months, and so they incredibly told her just to be careful and protect herself. A detective from Westchester County who had investigated Ben's murder, Allison Carpentier, loaned May Abad $5,000 to relocate herself and her children. The detective would lose her job for this kindness once Narcy and Cristobal went to trial and it was revealed. Finally, on July 8th, almost a year to the day of Ben's murder, the FBI arrested Narcy Novak at 6 a.m. while her brother Cristobal Valiz was arrested in New York at the exact same time. Both Alejandro Garcia and Joel Gonzalez had sang like canaries. The indictment charged them with conspiracy to commit interstate domestic violence and stalking because, according to author John Glatt, there was no federal murder statute they could use at the time. Interestingly, this law was instituted in 1994 after the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson, and it meant life in prison for Narcy and Cristobal if they were convicted. Finally, after the federal charges and arrests, the Fort Lauderdale police agreed to reopen Bernice Novak's case. Once the medical examiner read Alejandro Garcia's statement, he realized it matched Bernice's injuries exactly and now changed her death ruling to homicide. From his jail cell, Cristobal tried to have Alejandro Garcia killed before he could testify. He wanted Joel Gonzalez to shiv him in prison. But Gonzalez refused and then turned him in. On April 5th, an 11-count superseding indictment was filed in federal court on Narcy Novak and Cristobal Feliz for orchestrating Bernice Novak's death, racketeering, attempting to murder Alejandro Garcia, and Narcy was also charged with money laundering for the money she moved from the bank right after Ben's murder. Finally, on September 20th, more superseding indictments were filed against Narcy and Cristobal. The six felony counts included murder and aid of racketeering. The charge carried a mandatory life sentence without parole. The trial of Narcy Novak and Cristobal Valiz began on April 23, 2010, and would last for a dramatic 9 weeks. Alejandro Garcia made an excellent witness, with total recall. He told in a measured, matter-of-fact way of how he brutally murdered the elderly Bernice Novak as well as Ben Novak Jr. Joel Gonzalez was also an excellent witness, explaining how Narcy handed him the pillow to try and smother her husband and that she did give the order to kill him. Gonzalez also revealed that Cristobal Valiz had offered him $150,000 to implicate May Abad rather than Narcy Novak. Cell phone evidence from Narcy's burner phone to Cristobal and then the two hitmen only added more credibility to the hitmen's testimony. There were literally hundreds of calls between the siblings in the months leading up to the murders. Narcy Novak declined to testify in her own defense, but Cristobal stupidly took the stand, and the prosecution handily countered every lie with video surveillance, bank statements, phone records, and many other pieces of evidence. By the end of the trial, 60 witnesses had testified, and some 300 pieces of evidence were entered into the record. During the prosecution's closing argument, Cristobal stood up and again accused May Abad and was sternly admonished by the judge. He also tried to change his plea in the 11th hour and wanted to testify again, claiming he would tell the truth this time. The judge refused. The trial was over. Narcy Novak now declined to be in the courtroom as the verdicts were read. She had spent the entire trial stoically silent, insisting on wearing her prison orange jumpsuit when even May Abad had offered to bring her clothes to wear. On July 20th, the jurors found both Novak and Valiz guilty on all counts except one, which was the violent crime in aid of racketeering. This was because the government had never found Ben's gold bracelet, and as nothing else was taken from the hotel room that morning, they could not prove it was a robbery. So they were technically found not guilty of the felony murder of Ben Novak Jr. But Narcy Novak was found guilty of 12 of the federal counts, and Cristobal Valiz was found guilty of 14. At their sentencing, the lead prosecutor characterized the siblings as pathological liars and dangerous psychopaths. The judge agreed, sentencing them both to life in prison without parole. In following years, the two would try to turn on each other to cut new deals, but it didn't work. And now, though the criminal proceedings were over, the battle in probate court for Ben Novak Jr.'s estate was just getting started. The daughters of his aunt, Maxine Phil, who had since passed away, Meredith and Lisa Phil, sued, trying to extend Florida's slayer statute to Narcy's daughter and grandchildren. In Florida, as in many states, one cannot profit from a crime, meaning you cannot kill someone and still inherit their estate. The Phil stance was that Maya Bott and her children could still deposit money into Narcy's prison account, and the slayer statute should apply to them as well. The Phils also sought to have Ben Novak Jr.'s second will revoked, the will where he had left everything to Narcy except for codicils for his mother, Maya Bott, and her children. They charged that Ben Novak Jr. was under duress with threat of physical harm when he signed the second will. The case went all the way to the Florida District Court of Appeals, who ruled on July 29, 2015, that the slayer statute did not apply to Narcy's daughter or grandchildren. Though many legal experts feel the statute should be amended as it has been in other states, the Florida court held to the letter of the current law and granted Maya Bott and her children Ben Novak Jr.'s entire estate. However, they did remand for further proceedings on the second charge, that Ben Novak Jr.'s will should be revoked because it was made while he was under the threat of physical harm or duress. In the previous episode, I misspoke when I said the case was still being fought. I had trouble finding the court documents where it was settled. I did, however, hear back from Douglas Hoffman, the attorney for Ben Novak Jr.'s estate, that the will was not revoked, litigation was concluded, and the estate was closed. As there is no public record of this, and Mr. Hoffman did not elaborate, I believe a private settlement was reached between Maya Bott and the Phils. In years since, Ben Novak Jr.'s relatives have not made any public comments, but Maya Bott has been available for any and every interview in print or television. It still makes me wonder about all of her motivations. She had nothing to do with the murder of her stepfather, but she fought like a cat to maintain control of his estate, and she continues to profit by granting so many television appearances. But despite the ugly battle for the Novak fortune, there is only one true villain in this entire family saga, and that is Narcissa Valise Novak. Narcissa is a name derived from the Greek god Narcissus, which, as we know, is the root word for narcissism. Narcy Novak is the ultimate narcissist, only caring for herself and her own greed, with no love for anyone, not even her own daughter. She was characterized as a psychopath in court, which, as she has shown no empathy or remorse for her actions, seems fair. As she had told police in her very first interview, quote, "Only a monster could do this evil thing." Indeed, Mrs. Novak. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. There were numerous other minor players and accomplices to this twisted story, too many to go into, even in two episodes. So I heartily recommend John Glatt's book, The Prince of Paradise, the true story of a hotel heir, his seductive wife, and a ruthless murder. I also recommend Fool's Paradise by Stephen Gaines, who interviewed Bernice and Ben Novak Jr. shortly before their deaths. His book came out in January before the murders in 2009, but it is more a history of Miami Beach, while Glatt's book focuses specifically on the murders. However, there are countless true crime shows about this insane case, too many to name. But Beautiful and Twisted is a Lifetime movie starring Rob Lowe as Ben, Candace Bergen as Bernice, and Paz Vega as Narcy. While it skips much of the background detail and takes quite a few liberties, the murders, as shown on screen, are graphic and pretty close to what actually happened. You can rent it on Amazon Prime, and I admit, it is fun in a campy way. Don't forget, I will be at the True Crime Podcast Festival in Chicago on July 13th. It will be held at the Marriott downtown, right on the Magnificent Mile. This festival is strictly for True Crime Podcast addicts. 90 of your favorite podcasters will be there for you to meet and scoop up swag. This is a full-day event with several panel discussions, live episodes, and a huge meet and greet. I will be a panelist along with Justin from The Generation Y, Josh from True Crime Bullshit, Laura from Crime Writers On, and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed. Fest. To purchase tickets or learn more, go to truecrimepodcastfestival.com or look for it on social media. I hope to see you there. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. Sometimes private messages on social media get lost, so email is best, and please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.